Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your car chill duet of music, news, and criticism. I am your host, John Caramonica.
Well, I got my first truck when I was three. Drove 100,000 miles on my knees. Hauled marbles and rocks and thought twice before I hauled a Barbie doll bed for the girl next door. She tried to pay me with a kiss and I began to understand there's something women like about a pickup man.
Look, you guys have been going through the same pandemic that I've been going through. It's been 5 months. One of the tough parts, especially in their first month or two, was the sense that the coronavirus was taking people at a kind of unbearable clip. And I found myself writing a bunch of obituaries of musicians, especially in those first couple of months. And, you know, as a journalist and as a critic, it's a challenge to see what happens when a health crisis like this really starts to decimate a population. What I don't want to get lost is the joy and the thrill of the music made by those people. And so what I wanted to do on Popcast, and this will be the first episode, I think we're going to do this 1, 2, 10, who knows, a couple more times, is I wanted to spotlight a few of the musicians that we've lost, tell their stories, play their music, and really basically have a wake. Let's celebrate what they did. And so on this week's episode, we're going to have three segments talking about three artists. So to talk about DJ Black and Mild, we're going to call in with Elena Bergeron, who is an editor on the sports desk at the Times, and most crucially is from New Orleans. For Nisham Wooden, we're going to talk to Jacob Bernstein, who is a writer at the Times Styles desk. First off, we are going to talk about Joe Diffie. Joe died at 61 early in the coronavirus pandemic. Joe Diffie was, in the early 90s, very much a star of his time. Party records, ballads, down home, little bit of a sense of humor. Not the arena-sized stuff that was happening around him, not exactly the same stuff, but very much in the vein of the superstars of that era. And if we're talking Joe Diffie, you know we're talking to Holly Gleason. Holly, how are you?
I'm happy to be here.
Holly, I want to say, first off, you were one of the first people in Nashville that was ever nice to me. Maybe one of the last people. No, I'm just playing.
Well, I knew who you were. You know, I read Vibe, and I worked in black music too with the Daz Band, so I got it.
I always appreciated that, you know, especially coming to Nashville from New York as an outsider, I was grateful for the hospitality then and now. So thank you for that.
My pleasure.
Let's talk a little bit about Joe Diffie. And I want to talk a little bit about where he came from before he was a star. And then we'll kind of jump right into the early 90s stuff. But talk us through kind of Joe's backstory.
Joe was kind of that good kid from Oklahoma, played sports, played bluegrass, and kind of like Garth Brooks, had the same dream. The difference was, I think Garth got with people that have much bigger vision, and Joe fell in with the bluegrassers and the really, really old school songwriters, like people who weren't necessarily in favor.
Right, at that moment in Nashville, because that's a real, if we're going to just briefly talk about the era in which Joe Diffie was really popping, that is not a rootsy era in Nashville. That's a, I'm making like a pumping motion, like you're pumping up a tire. It's like big, beefy, loud arena country.
Well, it wasn't even that. I think that we were on the back end of what I call the Rico Suave thing with the dudes in the members only jackets and medallions. And the traditionalist thing had burned away and we were sort of trying to find ourselves. And the tragic name of the moment were Cats in Hats. So you had Alan Jackson and you had Clint Black and you had Vince Gill, who didn't wear a hat, and I guess just because he was a boy, he got shoved in with them. And then George Strait was starting to have his ascent. But they love the idea of women like these dudes. And Ricky Van Shelton was sort of signed as the back draft of that. And then Ricky Van Shelton sort of begat the CBS Nashville, then Sony Nashville, Colin Ray, Joe Diffie, Doug Stone cavalcade of Hardwired to the Middle.
And Diffie, in your opinion, you wrote some really sharp things about his voice. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what he brought vocally that was specific.
Like I said, Joe came out of bluegrass, and that is a very aggressive, very on the note, very coming down on the note. And he had a tone that was porous, but it wasn't nasal. So when it came at you, it went into you, but it wasn't offensive.
Right.
Or, I mean, I think Ralph Stanley sounds amazing, but I don't play Ralph Stanley for the kids I grew up with who listen to Bruce Springsteen.
Right. Those bluegrass vocals can be neat, like they can needle in a kind of way.
Yeah.
So at the top of the episode, we obviously opened with Pickup Man, which, you know, is part of, it's part of what Joe Diffie did, which are these kind of like broad, casually comic, but also a little bit gentle anthems. That was part of it. Can you talk about the kind of push and pull in Diffie between big songs like that and some of the more gentle balladry and more reserved stuff? Because he really did do both and kind of excelled in two different lanes at minimum.
Well, that comes back from that old school, old guard songwriting crew that he hung with. You know, the idea of wordplay was important to them. The idea that something was punny, they knew how to pull it back before it got dorky, and they weren't afraid to go for it. So he had that not quite novelty record. It was never funny enough to be novel, but it was anthemic, like Prop Me Up Beside the Jukebox When I Die, or John Deere Green, you know? The whole town said he should have used red, but it looked up to Charlene and John Deere Green.
On a hot summer night, he wrote Billy Bob Love Charlene and let her 3 foot high. And the whole town said that he should have used red, but it looked up to Charlene.
They knew how to put a really big, jacked up truck backbeat under those songs. But the thing that I think made Joe really stand out was ballads. Like his balladry and his ability to get inside a song that was just gut-wrenching, I would put him with Ronnie Dunn as maybe the best hard country singer of the last 30 years.
Let's play one of those ballads.
The big one is Ships That Don't Come In,
yep,
which got nominated for CMA Song of the Year. And because we had three men, we never chased one specific guy. The attitude was always, well, if somebody gets in, but when you split your votes, nobody gets in.
Let's play Ships That Don't Come In, Joe Diffie.
So here's to all the soldiers who have ever died in vain. Insane locked up in themselves, the homeless down on Main. To those who stand on empty shores and spit against the wind, and those who wait forever for ships that don't come in.
So the thing that I sort of always liked about this song is I feel like coming from another singer, it might have been kind of almost like unbearably sentimental, so kind of mired in the darkness that you didn't really connect to the essence of the melody in the song. But it's not overly sentimental what Joe's doing here.
No, and I also think, you know, what Joe got that a lot of people didn't was the idea of all emotions are complicated, and you have to leave room for the complication. You also have to leave room for the listener. But there's a note in that song, right, where he goes, and folks who wait forever, and it's that big note. He doesn't set it up like, hey, dig me. I'm going to drop the big note. So when he takes it, he literally pulls your chest out of your heart. And you feel all the futility and all the commitment to the dream that doesn't happen. And the guy isn't a fool. He's a hero. That's what Joe did with Ballads. And I mean, is it cold in here or is it you?
Oh,
like
yeah.
The ultimate. Ooh. Marriage falling apart.
Oh, yeah. Hell of a title. Hell of a song, but also just hell of a title.
Yeah, and that was his deal, was he left room. We did a showcase for Joe at the Roxy in 91 or 92. And my boss was always great about, well, what do you want to do? Because I would always come up with crazy stunts. And I said, let's get Tammy. Mm. Let's get Tammy to come. And so, and she was always up for something fun. And she loved to sing with Joe. She loved to sing with Joe Diffie. I mean, here's Jones and Wynette. And so we asked her and she agreed to come out. And she stayed in the same hotel as us. And, you know, we had a big old time. But she got up on stage and actually said, other than George Jones, there's no man I'd rather sing with.
Wow.
Yeah.
Damn.
Yeah, that's, I mean, it's strong.
That's incredibly strong. And you know, obviously people are given to, you know, being hyperbolic and whatnot, but that guy, I'm sure she took that very seriously. Like, you know, I mean, that's Tammy Wynette and George Jones. Like, you know, that's not just two arbitrary singers. Those, that's like a defining duo. So, you know, I think if she was going to say something like that, I bet she meant it.
She didn't throw George's name around like footballs. And it wasn't something that was discussed. It wasn't free range. Tell me about the time. She never told me the tractor story. And I had dinner with her quite a bit. We were friendly. She thought I was funny.
Accurate.
Yeah. And I took her places. You know, I took her to see Tom Petty, you know. And she loved, she liked Joe. They were musically curious people. You know, one of the things about Joe is he was very capable of writing these sort of funny songs, but he also, you know, could write like just a really heart-wrenching song. He also is a vocalist, and I don't think he got enough credit. He always sort of subconsciously voiced songs for men like him.
Oh, that's interesting. That's interesting. Talk about that, because I do think, you know, we forget sometimes that singers are embodying characters. I mean, they're, you know, sometimes it's autobiographical, sometimes it's not, but they are embodying characters. Tell me about the Joe Diffie man.
I mean, this is a little bit kind of ironic how you make the sausage, but when I first went to work at the record company, having been a journalist, I had no idea. They had a trainer and a nutritionist on the road because they were hell-bent they were going to beat him into being a romantic balladeer because he sang ballads so great. But every week, the report from the road was the weight went up. And I finally said to my boss, Joe's a pig, like nature versus nurture. He wants to eat. He's that guy. And he's also the guy who gets a lot of the girls because he's a good guy. He's a fun guy. He's a nice guy. He's a respectful guy. And I think there are more guys working at the Jiffy Lube and the trucking company that look like Joe than look like Ricky Van Shelton. So my boss like, wrote it up. So I sent him this white paper on Joe Diffie, and he got Danny and Johnny, his managers, to come over and, you know, he'll do a little presentation. And watching the lights go on over their head, they got it. They're like, oh, we know exactly what to do. That's how regular Joe was born.
Just to explain to everybody, at that time, what put you in this position to be helping to shape what became regular Joe?
I had, as you know, I was a journalist.
Yes, you started as a journalist. We were just talking about Cream the other day because of this documentary. So you started as a writer.
I was a writer, and I was a pretty big deal writer, but I moved for Hits Magazine to Nashville, and it wasn't going well because they didn't understand that the Nashville music business is a completely different music business. You know, all the nonsense about Drake versus Kenny Chesney with that number one. The truth is, our fans want CDs. Like, that's how they consume music. That wasn't a pimp. And so Hits and Nashville was not a good fit. I needed a job. Sony needed someone to do artist development and media relations. So I took over that department with no clue. And I started looking at why are these artists not working and where are their strengths. And with Joe, I mean, I was – stunned the first time I heard him sing. Because live, he was just a heat-seeking missile and could do it for hours, probably because those bluegrass people, they play all day and then they go to the campsite and they play all night. It's a lot of singing. Leanne Womack, the same school. And so Joe was always kind of my favorite, although you don't have favorites, you know that. Because his singing. Yeah. Well, that's the beauty of being a writer, yeah, right? Yeah. But he was just such a great singer. And, you know, I had gotten into country music through Johnny Anderson, who's another guy that's a nice pick, you know? And he had such good song sense. The first album, where they were trying to make him a romantic balladeer, like he sort of lacked his way through If the Devil Danced in Empty Pockets, which was this sort of Western swing thing. And then he was able to do Home, which was sort of the, what's the word? The bucolic greeting card of the values that I think when Nashville gets stymied, they always revert back to.
And more I'm thinking that the only treasures that I'll ever know are long ago and far behind, wrapped up in my memories of home. Home was a swimming hole.
You could tell they were trying to figure out where to put him. And then when we had this regular Joe meeting, they doubled down. The sad thing, Ships That Don't Come In was on there. Is It Cold In Here was on there. But then you had regular Joe.
You said that you could see the lights go on in his manager's eyes. Did it also kind of enliven him as well? And say, oh, I can just be, okay, I can be who I am, as opposed to...
No, he called me laughing and he said, thank you. Thank you. Now I can get back to doing what I do. And the truth is, he's a blue collar kid from nowhere. That was the essence of who he was. And with regular Joe having such a good response, and that was, we were getting ready to put the record out when they did that. Right? So they stuck him in a wife beater, dragged him down to Tootsie's, put him in the front room. That's the album cover. For the second album of the regular Joe, that was Honky Tonk Attitude. And that was where it really came together for him. And he was fearless. He was a fearless singer.
These big records that became his kind of, you know, the rowdier side of his hits, in your mind, do you think that that almost like narrowed the perception of what he was capable of doing or what his career was?
Well, I think the tragedy, because you're being courteous, but I think you're implying that. I think that, you know, I left the label. I couldn't take the way Sausage was made. Some of the other people who were more the old guard also left. And the new people that came in didn't really understand what it was about Joe Diffie. And the novelty record. It happened to Diamond Rio, also a great band that came out of bluegrass to an extent. It happened to Pam Tillis. When in doubt, you know, let the laughs come out. And so he got swallowed by novelty records. I mean, Third Rock from the Sun was genius. The way it was written, it was so tight. And he knew how to sing that song with just enough of a wink that you kind of knew he was in on the joke. But then, you know, and Pickup Man was that. But then it started to become more of the Bigger Than the Beatles and the Nehru Jacket and Back to the Cave. And it wasn't him anymore.
Right. And like you tell a joke enough times and it's not a joke anymore. Like that's the thing. And that's, you know, just a particular issue. I don't think that's particular to Nashville or to country music, but I do think that for a lot of professional musicians who end up with two or three songs in a particular style that maybe had a hint of spark or radicalism in them, by the third one, it's not there anymore. And if you do three more and six more and nine more, you may seem like you're doing the same thing, but really what you're doing is deadening a style that actually had novelty at one point. So it does seem like a little bit of that is what's going on here.
It also felt like a push. I mean, it's like it wasn't natural to that guy in the flyover. It wasn't like it was funnier, it was clever, but it wasn't a joke he would have made. And the other thing that they lost, sadly, was here was one of the greatest ballad singers ever in the format. And he had two managers. Danny Morrison was a short, square man. Johnny Slate was tall and thin. They had written hits for Razzie Bailey and Charlie Pride. And I mean, old school. And I think that they weren't able to stand up to the new guard. And so they listened instead of going, wait a minute, we're redneck people. That's what we do. And by the way, have you listened to this guy sing? So you have these kind of slick Sony people who don't get why Merle Haggard is a lifestyle, not a choice.
That notion of lifestyle, the idea of regular Joe, the idea that people are going to identify with that person, and certainly perhaps in contrast with some of the more polished, bigger names of that era, who obviously are doing tremendous things musically and also popularity-wise, but maybe aren't quite as touchable as Joe Diffie was.
He was someone that when you looked at him, it was very much Ferris Bueller. He was our guy living the dream. And when you went to his shows, they were parties. Everybody was having a ball. If you had come to cry to the ballads, there was sort of a crying zone, like the crying room at the movie theater. So you'd leave those people alone. But people had a ball. And his goodness, you know, right before he died, I'd run into him at the Opry. And, you know, we stood and laughed for 20 minutes about nothing. And we were texting. And he never lost that. He never lost how much he loved people, how much he loved people that would work at Sam's Club or people who might be, you know, picking oranges or tomatoes or peaches. He didn't care who you were. And I think that came out when he sang. And I think it's when the songs were matched to that, people knew the difference.
Before we go, can we just talk for a moment about his songwriting? Because the thing that I did not know before I was prepping his obituary was that he was one of the writers, or maybe the writer, of the Jody Messina record, Might Give a Damn's Busted.
I was actually going to bring that up next.
Okay, good. Let's play a tiny second of Might Give a Damn's Busted, which I love to know it.
You can say you've got issues. You can say you're a victim. It's all you After all, you didn't pick them. Maybe somebody else has got time to listen. Might Give a Damn's Busted.
After he was no longer a factor at radio and he got to go back to being Joe Diffie and he got back to writing songs, he got to go back to telling, for lack of a better term, his truth, right? And because he did a version of it. And it was like, I laughed when I heard it because he would send me his records because he was nice that way. And I just remember thinking, oh yeah, well, this is how he really feels.
Right.
And when he tells his truth, some plumber in Arizona is going, damn right.
Yeah. True. We could do this for a long time, but Holly, what a treat it is to remember Joe Diffie with you.
Yeah, I miss him.
Like no other, flawless, absolutely flawless.
We are going to pivot right now to talk about Nesham Wooden. Nesham, better known perhaps as Mona Foote, a legendary New York drag queen. Nesham died at 50, presumably of the coronavirus. It was very early in the pandemic. Information was a lot more scarce. Testing was tougher to come by. And Nesham had a sort of a polymathic career in New York downtown nightlife, Barracuda, The Cock, Boy Bar, essential spots in New York's gay nightlife, and everything from a host of a talent show to working door, working bar, to performing. And at the beginning of the segment, we heard a song that was put out by The Ones. This was a trio, a dance music trio that Nesham was in, and that song was called Flawless. And so to talk about Nesham's life and career, I've got Jacob Bernstein here. Jacob, what's good, man?
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. Happy you're here, man.
Me too. So, you know, Nisham was this person who grew up in Brooklyn. He was a native New Yorker. And by the sort of late 80s, he is living with the Lady Bunny, who is one of our great drag queens. And the Lady Bunny's other roommate from around that time was RuPaul. And he begins performing at a place called Boy Bar in the East Village, which actually was a seminal club for drag. Boy Bar was sort of cabaret is too Pollyanna-ish or whatever to describe
polite,
what it was.
Too polite a phrase.
It's too polite, too polite a phrase. But it wasn't an after-hours nightclub either. And in fact, Nisham at the same time was a sort of character who was known at the Sound Factory, which was where Madonna had found Jose and Louis and Vogue and all of that stuff. So he's sort of at this intersection of performing drag queens and or lip syncing drag queens and after hours nightclub culture. And he begins working at Patricia Field, running their men's department and kind of buying all of the sort of space age gear that club kids at that time are buying.
I mean, I remember going to Patricia Field in like 92 and just like having my mind blown, you know, coming from like the far outer boroughs to go to Patricia Field and just being like, they didn't have anything like this in Mill Basin. You know what I mean? That was one of Nisham's homes.
Yes. And in fact, I mean, Patricia Field really was this place that if you were a New York drag character and one of the ones who ultimately became famous or semi-famous, the overwhelming odds are that you at one point or another worked there. You know, I mean, Candace Kane, who appeared on that ABC show and the Caitlyn Jenner show, had started there, and Amanda Lepore worked there. And I believe that Girlina, who's now known as Lena Bradford, and DJs sort of all over the world work there, and so did Nisham. So there's this whole group of people. I think there's a way of classifying life as people who are 5 minutes too early, 5 minutes too late, or right on time. And in some way, I think that Nisham was one of those people who was always 5 minutes too early, because he didn't have the kind of enormous career that RuPaul wound up having.
Speaking of RuPaul, one of the things that when you're reading up on Nisham's career that seems pretty, I don't know if it's 100% evident, but it seems certainly very likely, Mona Foote hosted a Star Search talent competition, in many ways considered an antecedent, if not the antecedent, to RuPaul's Drag Race. Can we talk a little bit about the development of the Mona Foote character? Because there's also some very early, I was looking on YouTube, there's some very early footage, wig stock footage from the early 90s. So the Mona Foote character is already kind of in full flower by that point.
Yes, he begins sort of performing at Boy Bar. And the original idea for him, as sort of conceived by one of the promoters there, is that he will be this sort of kind of mammy-ish character, possibly even wearing something that makes him look hefty. And Nisham was quite strapping and muscular, but he was never what you would have called hefty. And so he kind of begins wearing this Wonder Woman costume instead and doing this sort of space age character. And it was weird looking in a certain way, because if you talk about somebody like RuPaul, I mean, RuPaul, there really was a certain kind of Black Miss America thing to his alter ego, where it was a fairly straightforward, feminized drag image. And Nisham is wearing these little skirts and this sleeveless thing, and you're seeing this like beefcake guy, like just bulging out of it. And also, unlike RuPaul, whose whole persona was about, in some way, inclusivity and love yourself, love everyone else, Nisham's character was a little bit more steeped in the tradition of throwing shade. And boy, did he know how to do that.
I was Googling around and I landed on just like a short tribute on, I believe, Caswell's Facebook page. And it said something to the effect of, what a tragic loss to lose Nasham, Mona Foote, who I'm sure is reading someone to filth right now in heaven as we speak. And that was part of the character. There's the Michael Musto interview in Paper from a few years ago where I think Nasham says, you know, I hope no one was ever offended. I hope people understood that, you know, they could find the humor in it even when I was going after them.
Candace Kane actually said to me when I was doing the obit on him that there was this central irony because on stage he could really cut a bitch. That was the phrase that she used. And in life he was a mensch. Now that didn't mean he wasn't judgmental because I knew him a little bit for 25 years, I guess. And the phrase gimlet eye fits completely.
How successful was Mona Foote in the context of New York City drag, in the context of those, in basically the East Village of the late 80s into the 90s? How successful was Mona Foote?
There was really only one crossover person at that time, and it was RuPaul. And in fact, at that time, RuPaul's crossover, let's not forget, was fairly short-lived. It really wasn't until there was this one giant pop hit that got picked up again and again for advertising campaigns. But there was no other pop hit besides Supermodel. And then the show came along and changed his life and drag as we know it. But if you were naming the top 10 drag queens of that era, he wouldn't be top five, but he would probably be in the lower half of that. I mean, this was not a person who was semi-known in that world. He was known, and Star Search was really magic because he was just so funny. And there were great drag performers, and there were terrible ones. And sometimes you did sort of feel for them when he went at them. But you go up there knowing what you're in for.
Oh, yeah. You're not naive about it.
Yes.
With Flawless and the ones, it's not Supermodel, which is obviously the kind of drag pop hit of that era. But the ones, which is Nasham with a couple other performers, put out a song called Flawless that does very well, especially in Europe. There's a bunch more songs by the ones. I was checking on Discogs. There's sort of a longer catalog than you'd think. There was one on that I saw on YouTube that I had not heard of called Face and Body, which seemed maybe kind of like a post Supermodel deliberate choice to kind of go in that a similar direction.
Although isn't every drag song on some level about face and body? I mean,
yeah, sure. Right?
I mean, this is sort of the genre that we're in.
Face and body, give me face and body, give me body and face.
So he, in the late 90s, gets cast in a movie called Flawless that Joel Schumacher directs and that, ironically enough, or strangely enough, I was a locations assistant. I worked...
What?
Yes, I was in college and that was sort of my college job. And
Wow.
And I was pretty good at it because I had grown up in New York City. And so I knew the town pretty well. And so Nasham got cast. And so we were all sort of hanging out on Avenue A for a month and a half while he filmed it. And this movie was maybe not one of Joel Schumacher's better movies, but it did have Philip Seymour Hoffman and Robert De Niro. And Philip Seymour Hoffman plays a drag queen. And Nasham is sort of one of his sidekick girlfriends. And so he does that and then writes this song. And it becomes a sort of surprise pop hit really all over Europe. I mean, it goes to like number 7, I think, in the UK. And it's really everywhere. And George Michael then covers it. And it's sort of George Michael's kind of his last pop hit.
There's also, if you look on YouTube, there is a performance on Top of the Pops, of the ones performance on Top of the Pops. obviously, if you've lived in England for any stretch of time, you know that Top of the Pops can be this sort of strange melange of genres and kind of like car crashing from one style of song to the next. But there they are performing with like a whole choreographed dance routine with like 7 or 8 additional dancers. It's quite a thing. So anyway, go check that out.
Yes. And in fact, I think that one of the things that's interesting about the ones is that Nisham by this point has sort of moved out of the Mona Foote character for a variety of reasons we can discuss, but he winds up in this group that is much more sort of gender ambiguous and a kind of club kid meets 2001, A Space Odyssey. The visuals of the ones are kind of post-apocalyptic 2001 Mad Max-ish, whatever. And in fact, if you look now at what's going on in the zeitgeist, where we seem to be moving out of gender binaries and into spaces that are more ambiguous, the ones are sort of precede that in some way, right? And I think, again, that this is another sort of way in which Nisham was a person who perhaps didn't get that rich because he was always a little early and edgy.
And also there's something he said in the paper interview that really jumped out at me, talking about eventually walking away from Mona Foote. Said, towards the end, I became miserable because it wasn't my dream to be some downtown nightlife drag queen superstar. It seemed like it was out of my control. I was making so much money and losing myself in the character. No matter how much I introduced myself as Nisham, people called me Mona. They still do, and I don't love it. And that's 2016 or 2017. So, you know, unlike perhaps other performers in that scene for whom that was the kind of the end goal, it seems like there was something slightly accidental about how he arrived into the character and then a kind of prolonged desire to get away from the character.
Can we unpack that for a minute, actually? Because I think there's something underneath what he's saying that, I mean, I actually know that there's something underneath what he's saying, which is Nisham liked guys and he liked guys. And he was physically a guy's guy. And he met an awful lot of people over the years who were very into him physically until they found out that he was also a drag queen. And then there's a huge amount of internalized homophobia that makes it kind of difficult to be a drag queen if you are actually happy living as a guy outside of when you're performing as a nightclub entity. And so he got rejected enough times by guys who otherwise would have been all over him that he internalized it and he got tired of it and wanted to escape it. And I think that if you look at him physically, one of the things that's interesting about it is that he embodies the idea that it's all drag, right? Because he's able to go back and forth between this kind of hyper-masculine, almost Tom of Finland-like character to Mona Foote. And I was watching these two cops on horseback a few weeks ago. I have no idea if this is usable or even going to get me fired. But I was watching these two guys on these horses with their sunglasses and their body armor, like at 2 o'clock in the afternoon going up 8th Avenue. And suddenly it just hits me like this is drag. This is just man drag, you know? I mean,
yeah, it's authority drag.
Yes, it's authority drag and it's superhero drag. And Nisham was attracted to a version of that.
No, he talks about being into Wonder Woman as a superhero, not simply as a vehicle for drag, but as a superhero. He talked about wanting to be a pop superhero in this interview. That was something that early in his life was attractive to him.
Yes, and so I think Nisham was naturally a person who was kind of quite comfortable darting back and forth between different gender archetypes that were in fact seemingly oppositional, but it wasn't so easy for other people, and particularly gay men, many of whom have internalized a huge amount of homophobia to deal with. We all came up at a time where homophobia was really rampant, and there was this simultaneous push to be a sort of Tom of Finland character. And so Nisham kind of gets the best and worst of all of this. Although more of the best, I would say.
After Nisham sort of left the Mona character behind. It was still a presence in the gay nightlife scene in New York.
There was a sort of Zelig-like quality to Nisham's existence because he goes from Patricia Field to and the Sound Factory and Boy Bar to the Cock in the East Village when that sort of aesthetic replaces Chelsea and after hours nightclubs that sort of go out of favor when Giuliani becomes mayor and Bloomberg kind of continues in the crackdown on nightlife, particularly sort of after hours dance clubs, right? And so Nisham sort of winds up at the Cock and he's bartending there and he looks very sexy behind the bar doing this. And he's sort of playing festivals around the world and hanging out with all of the people who really defined what New York nightlife culture was. And he was always at, you know, he was at movie premieres and he was very, very chic. And the other thing about Nisham is that the nightlife world is just littered with people who had real talent and ideas and fell apart because of drugs. And Nisham just didn't have that problem. I think he certainly probably went through phases or whatever and tried things, but Nisham was fundamentally not messy. And he got up in the morning and he went to the gym all the time and he was present with his friends. And so that in some ways enabled him to remain in the scene. It's that thing of you don't get high on your own supply. It's the DJs who last, the promoters who last. The reason Suzanne Bartsch has lasted as long as she did is because Suzanne Bartsch doesn't even care about drugs. She just wants to get dressed up. And so Nisham was fundamentally in all of this because he was moved by the music and the pageantry and the idea of nightlife, I think, as utopia. I mean, he once said to me that when he'd walked into Sound Factory the first time, that he just had this thought that this was changing the world.
Well, thank you, Jacob, for calling in to talk about Nisham Wooden. I appreciate you, man.
Back at you.
Black am I.
Drop the beat.
For our final segment today, we are going to talk about DJ Black and Mild. DJ Black and Mild was a New Orleans bounce DJ radio host. He died at 44 from the coronavirus. Bounce, a very, very localized subset of hip hop specific to New Orleans. And Black and Mild was a beloved figure in the city. Fortunately, we are lucky enough at the times to have New Orleans' own Elena Bergeron in the building.
I don't know if I am allowed.
You want to drag me for my pronunciation?
Yeah, I can't speak to you if you're going to keep saying it that way. They're not going to let me back in the city.
Oh, geez. I did just listen to the Dean Baquet long form podcast episode. So that pronunciation or attempted pronunciation is seared on my tongue. My apologies. Dean Baquet, come on, podcast. Okay, I'll stop. Elena, when I texted you, and I said, you know, tell me about your familiarity with DJ Black and Mild. You were like, hell yeah. Hell yeah. So can you sort of map out the groundwork of where he sat in the bounce music ecosystem?
Yeah, man. He is like one of the fundamental DJs within bounce. And I would say like particularly in like the 2000s in this century, like he's pretty much one of the foundational members of the bounce community, mostly because like, not only was he a part of the DJ culture there, meaning like actual live shows and, you know, call and response at clubs and at different venues. But especially after Katrina, he was one of the bounce DJs that really connected with everybody who wanted to hear bounce in the digital space. Because prior to this, you know, New Orleans is a live music city. We go to clubs. These DJs DJ our school dances. You will get a DJ Chicken bounce mixtape in the parking lot of a number of Popeyes in the city. So like that physical transaction with the music is still people's primary point of reference. But it was guys like, you know, DJ Black and Mild that really started to take things to the radio, take different mixtape shows and bounce shows to Ustream. You know, he's got an amazing Magnolia Shorty tribute that, you know, was on Ustream before it was on YouTube. And after Katrina, you know, I think he did some work at the radio station in Houston. But yeah, he was one of those people that was sort of a digital pioneer. He really expanded the footprint online.
Yeah. And how important was that? Because we, you know, obviously we think of bounce as so specifically regional, but obviously we know in the internet era, nothing regional can stay. Was there at all a tension between people who were like, don't put it on, like, don't share it with everybody, and people who were like, no, 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 I want to share it? Or was it understood that putting it out online was like, that's always a positive thing?
I never got the sense that there was that much of a backlash to him going online, in part because, like I said, it was after Katrina and people were dispersed. So, you know, New Orleans, especially prior to that time, it's a small city, but it's a city where you can trace who you know, where your family is from, based on like what block, what high school they went to. People did not leave New Orleans for generations. And so when it came to being homesick or, you know, people having caught buses to God knows where, being able to experience bounce music online really did become a connective tissue. But then like, secondly, he helped bounce DJs make money. Like selling his mixes on MySpace and, you know, doing streaming shows, he started a collective called Go DJs, where a lot of the local DJs who had access to the music but did not have the digital fluency to take it online, like he connected them to that and I think expanded, you know, what their audiences would have been.
You've been to parties, Black and Mild parties?
I've been to parties. I don't go to too many parties. I try to keep it in the crib a little bit because, you know, I don't fight. I am not licensed to carry a handgun. And so I personally feel maybe a little bit like I'm too soft to be up in a DJ Mild party for real, for real.
Hypothetically, if such a party existed, how turnt would it have been? Very turnt? Extremely turnt? Severely turnt?
That's one of the spaces where like the walls are sweating and people sell drinks that come in plastic cups and you'll know like how much liquor is actually in them or whatever. And, you know, people are not necessarily concerned with high posting at all. Like if you are not on the dance floor, backing it up, twerking upside down against the wall, pee popping, like you are in the wrong place. So yeah, it's beyond turnt. I don't think turnt is a good word for it, because turnt to me is like, you know, 1,000 kids jumping to internet rap, where like at a DJ Black Mob party, you know, people are actively like doing dances.
Right. So then, and again, also some parts specific to bounce, which is just how integral dance is to it. Not that dance is not important to other regions or other areas or styles of hip hop, but you know, you think of some of the kind of signature bounce and you're thinking about the physicality of it. You mentioned a little bit earlier before we were recording about Black and Mild DJing kind of around some of the same time that Big Frida was coming up. Obviously, very kinetic physicality going on there.
You're so articulate. What a way to phrase it. Yeah, I think like that's how you know a song works, right? Like you take it to that space and you try and rock a crowd. And if people are not like bouncing, twerking, if they're not competitive with the twerks, like, you know, I'm trying to steal your man, watch me work, then that music isn't what you think it is in the booth. And like, I would say though, on the spectrum of turntness of bounce events, like Black and Mild was probably on the less turnt side, because folks like Frida or like Hot Sizzle at this point, you know, really be going the whole show. Whereas like Black and Mild's mixes, you know, New Orleans loves R&B, bro. Like, Black and Mild remix,
yeah.
Jill Scott song, you know what I mean? Like, Black and Mild definitely did some damage on a Monica song. New Orleans love Monica, bro. But, like, yeah, like, DJ Black and Mild could bounce out, like, a song that you were just like, oh, no, that's a slow song. Like, I didn't even think of it that way until you hear his remix and you're bent over kind of involuntarily.
How much do you miss bounce now that you live in New York?
I mean, I miss bounce all the time because, like, now it has achieved a wider fame and become a little bit of, like, I just feel like kind of co-opted by white feminism a little bit. So, yeah, like, some of the stuff before the pandemic where, you know, people would be like, are you going to Brooklyn Bowl? Because Frida's going to be there. You know, we've never felt so free as at a Frida show. And I'm like, no. I am super happy for Frida getting a bag, but, like, that's not what I want.
Right. And also, I remember, I think we were actually talking about this, again, maybe a few months ago, where you were sort of, you know, whether it's the Drake adoption of Bounce or other, you know, other songs by non-New Orleans artists taking on a bounce aesthetic. This is something that is on your mind. It's in your heart. Something that gives you pause.
It's all about bounce. Is that safe to say? It's safe to say. It's on my mind. It's in my heart. It's in your inbox. Because, like, every time, you know, Moneybagg Yo or somebody else, like, remixes a bounce song, I'm like, John, you heard this? You can't have a top 10 hit without a bounce track underneath it. I don't know that, you know, Moneybagg Yo has top 10 hits, but, like, certainly when it comes to, like, what music sounds like and what music is aimed at, like, getting people to dance, that is hip hop music. Like, I feel like every part of it borrows from bounce right now. Like, there's Cardi songs that have, like, the backbone of a bounce track that you're like, oh, do people recognize that, like, the reason that they're dancing or the reason why X, Y, and Z dances are popular is because people have become so much more used to hearing, you know, bounce influenced hip hop.
You were talking about kind of bounce's relationship to R&B. And when I think of how DJs like Black and Mild refract other genres through bounce, it obviously reminds me a lot of, you know, DJ Screw refracting R&B and other hip hop from other regions and even pop records through that very particular Houston lens. You know, before Chopped and Screwed music was widely known and disseminated and perhaps bastardized, you know, what Screw was an omnivore, taking in all these other styles and kind of making them almost subservient to his aesthetic. Bounce can function very similarly in the sense that the production and the beats are very, very specific, but it absorbs. It's pretty agnostic as far as source material. And that feels like very particular to regional scenes from the 90s and early 2000s, very pre-internet, you know, before things were much more fluid, sort of saying, well, yeah, like, we can listen to music like this, but it's going to be on our terms. You want to listen to R&B? Great, but it's going to be on these terms.
I would challenge that a little bit, mostly because of the unique nature of, like, what rocks a party in New Orleans. So, like, think about Frankie Beverly and Maze recording live albums in New Orleans, even though that's a group from Philly. Like, Maze will never go out of style in New Orleans. If you don't end your party with Before I Let Go, it wasn't a successful party. And I think, like, very specifically, New Orleanians, and because, like, there's a strong rooted R&B tradition going back to Alan Toussaint and other people, like, New Orleans really likes bounce and it really likes R&B, and that's how we want to party. So, like, even some of the classics of bounce, when you think about Hustla Hustla, here we go. Hustla has a Sade sample. Like, Kiss of Life is the background to that, plus a Trigger Man beat. So, like, when you think about that idea of, like, kind of wanting to feel free or feel loose, you get a little bit of that R&B background, put that bounce beat on it. See, bent over, hunched over already in the seat at the desk. You ain't even played no music, hunched over.
So at your twerk from home desk, Elena. Mm-hmm, yeah, I did that. So, you know, we had spoken a little bit about Fifth Ward Weeby, who obviously had other jobs besides being the bounce kingpin. Black and Mild also was, you were saying, he was a teacher. Talk a little bit about that kind of juggling of regular life and Bounce Fame.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a loss on many levels, more than just, you know, he used to make good mixtapes or he used to stream amazing Bounce sessions. It's also that loss that, like, this is a person that, you know, was a PE teacher, and he was somebody that was a football coach, and definitely was a mentor to the youth beyond being like an entrepreneur in the Bounce music space. And I think people forget that you lose that part too. New York is interesting in its way. And I think that, like, you know, kids who went to LaGuardia can probably testify to the fact that, you know, half their teachers probably had a role on Broadway at some point in their life. But like, New Orleans, musicians are just pervasive in the way of life there. Like, your music teacher might have a Grammy. You know what I mean? Like, these are people that have legit, actual, real ass music careers and might even be like seminal members of the music community. Might be a PE teacher. Gigi Jubilee was a special needs teacher and a football coach at public school. Like, there are people who are icons of our musical traditions who also drive cabs.
Wow. Elena, thank you for sharing a little bit of, I'm not going to say it, New Orleans Bounce context. And I know, a sigh of relief. And also explaining a little bit more about DJ Black and Mild, who I feel was not as widely covered in early Corona as some other folks. So I appreciate you coming and sharing some stories.
No problem. He did a lot for pumping remixes of Lumi D throughout the city for no good reason. And I appreciate it.
That is a noble path in life that we can all respect.
Later, John, man, you're crazy.
That's our show, our first of more than one, number TBD, of episodes celebrating the lives of musicians who were victims of the coronavirus. We want to keep it uplifting and positive. It's a wake. And so I want to thank Hallie Gleason, Jacob Bernstein, Elena Bergeron, and say rest in peace to Joe Diffie, Nashawn Wooden, and DJ Black and Mild. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Get on the Facebook group. Talk to us. podcastnytimes.com. If you want to drop us an email, subscribe to podcasts anywhere you get your audio content. Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, etc. Also, shout out Chris, Jacob's friend, who was hanging out last night, podcast listener, as we were saving from a technical meltdown. Shout out Chris for listening and for being a good sport. Our producer, Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. We'll be back next week, and we're going to go out with, I mean, how can you not go out with this Joe Diffie song? Here's Prop Me Up Beside the Jukebox If I Die.
Well, I ain't afraid of dying. It's the thought of being dead. I wanna go on being me once my eulogy's been read. Don't spread my ashes out to sea. Don't lay me down to rest. You can put my mind at ease if you fill my last request.
Prop me up beside the jukebox if I die.